from the Sky News Centre at 5. Relief efforts are underway in the Caribbean to help the British territories devastated by Hurricane Irma. UK troops have managed to restore power and communications in Anguilla and clear the airport runway. They've now arrived at the British Virgin Islands, which were also badly hit. Greek captain Tim Jones from Bryce Norton says they're flying 3 planes out there today.
It's about making sure the most important stuff gets there first, and also it's the weather factor. So there is another storm coming through the region, so we've had to weigh all these factors, make some very precise judgments.
The number of people known to have died following an earthquake in Mexico has risen to 32. It's the largest tremor to strike the country in a century and has toppled buildings. A doctor has been charged with 2 sexual assaults at hospitals in Oxford and Cambridge. The 26-year-old was arrested last year after a woman reported being assaulted at the John Radcliffe Hospital. He's also alleged to have attacked a woman 2 years before at Adam Brooks. The mum of a girl whose organs have helped a record-breaking 8 people hopes her story will encourage others to set out their wishes. 13-year-old Jemima Lazel died unexpectedly in 2012 from a brain aneurysm. She'd previously discussed organ donation with her parents. Her mum Sophie says she's very proud.
Just to know that her death had such a positive impact is incredibly important to us, to all those who knew her. We are very, very keen that people start talking about organ donation so that more people can be helped.
In sport, Manchester United boss Jose Mourinho says they voted against closing the transfer window early. Enough Premier League clubs were in favour of moving the summer deadline to before the first game of next season for it to be signed off yesterday. Normally, the window closes at the end of August. And at least 16 performances of the much-anticipated musical Hamilton in the West End have been rescheduled. The opening shows at Victoria Palace will now start on the 6th of December because of delays to renovation work there. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's 9/11 16th anniversary politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. It's a councillor and MP-free show this week. We're clearing the decks to take an in-depth look at 16 years, much of which is lies. As the war on terrorism begins to reach the age of adulthood, we know what happened on 9/11, don't we? Well, the answer is no. Most of us in the West don't. But many parts of the world, except the Western corporate media, see 9/11 as some kind of inside job, as an excuse to tear up the rulebook of international law to invade any country they like in the hunt for the terrorists. Some even say international law has been reduced now to where it was in 1930s Europe. A philosophy of might is right, backed up by wall-to-wall propaganda from mainstream press, which just amplifies the narrow views of bankers and military chiefs. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya and Syria are just the most obvious. But there's also the takeover of former Yugoslavia, most recently Montenegro by NATO, and ex-Soviet countries such as Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, and the biggest and most recent coup, nearly controlled by NATO but not quite, is Ukraine. And what does that mean? Well, it means that the latest boogeyman is President Putin. There's even whispers of trying to force regime change in Moscow. 9/11 legitimised the demonisation of Muslims too, an excuse for drones to kill freedom fighters opposing NATO occupations, in many ways like Hitler's hate campaign against the Jews in the 30s and 40s. Government policy has provided the perfect cover for racists. And on the economic side, with Gordon Brown's being bamboozled by history's greatest heist and the death of capitalism in 2008, we're limping along on imaginary money. The European Central Bank's now printing 2.5 trillion euros to prop up the zombie banks and the zombie markets. Finally, With tax-evading oligarchy replacing democracy and work no longer a route out of poverty for many, the gap is widening between the rich and the destitute. Our so-called leaders have created fertile ground for the rise of fascism and riots in the West too. Illegal wars abroad and loss of freedoms at home. Whatever happened to that peace dividend? And what part of the September the 11th, 2001 attacks played in all that? Well, to discuss this and much more, I'm joined by author Ian Henshaw. Hi, Ian. Welcome to Bristol.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about your book in the first place. What inspired you to write it?
I've been on a lot of radio shows, Tony, and they always ask what made you first suspicious. Not quite the same question, but let me tell you what. It was when I heard that after the attack on the Twin Towers and 9/11, they'd accidentally, well, by good luck, according to them, found intact the passport of one of the alleged hijackers. Now, that's very credible if you think the whole thing's some sort of setup, because they needed to sew a paper trail. But how on earth, if you believe the official story, did that passport survive the inferno of the towers, to be found in the middle of crisis hit New York, rapidly handed into the FBI and identified on the news programs that night as proof of the official story?
Well, hang on, there was an explosion, I seem to remember, when the plane hit the building. Surely the explosion could have blown the passport away so that it kind of fluttered down.
Well, that's what they said, Tony. Personally, that strikes me as unlikely, but I guess you'd have to replicate a plane blowing up to see. I think intuition suggested to me that this wasn't true.
I suppose a fireball might not necessarily leave the passport uncharred.
This passport was in such good nick, and they found another one on flight 93 as well, buried in the ground, which didn't seem to quite match the alleged hijacker, but maybe it did at a stretch. I look into all that in my book.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, this whole thing of the passport seems to have also been appearing recently, doesn't it, in many of the other attacks, including the ones on mainland Europe.
Indeed. I mean, it's astonishing how these jihadi terrorists leave their passports lying around and their identity documents, like the Kouachi brothers and Charlie Hebdo. They left their passports and identity documents in the getaway car, as you would if you're a professional terrorist.
And we also had a similar sort of thing in the Barcelona attack as well, apparently. The most recent.
Indeed, yes. In other words, there's a pattern here. 9/11 is effectively the daddy of all of these subsequent
events. Let's just assume for a minute that these terrorists didn't necessarily bring their passports, wouldn't think, oh, I must take my passport everywhere with me in case the police check me or something, I can prove to say who I am, and I leave my passport in my vehicles, etc. What would be the purpose of somebody planting a passport?
Well, it would have to be somebody who's, up to no good, and perhaps it indicates that there was something dodgy about the alleged hijackers. I mean, we can talk about that. In fact, there's an enormous amount that's dodgy about them, starting with the fact that at least one of them couldn't possibly have flown the plane he's supposed to have flown, and that's based on reports from the flight school he was at.
Okay, so in the most recent terrorist attacks we've seen, that many of them, particularly the ones in the run-up to the British general election, which all seem to, thank God, have stopped now. One does wonder if they had something to do with the general election, but so we had three attacks here in Britain. And all those cases, those people, the main ringleaders, were known to the authorities, known to the security services and people like MI5, many of whom had also been reported, Martin, to the anti-terror hotline.
Yes, that's right. And in actual fact, if you think about the context of 9/11, the Western intelligence services have an intimate relationship with jihadi terrorists going back to the 1980s. Operation Cyclone, the biggest undercover operation in history in terms of finance. The film with Tom Hanks in it called
Charlie Wilson's War. It's a good film, actually.
It's a very good film.
It's well worth watching.
And of course, it's made from the US perspective, where they basically boast about the fact that they created jihadi terrorism. And then, of course, the official story is that Al-Qaeda, which was created with Osama bin Laden working closely with the CIA, SAS, etc., and then he went rogue. But, of course, the story is very clear. Al-Qaeda was created by the Western intelligence services and the Saudis.
Yeah,
and nobody disputes that.
They like to make out that, it all stopped in 1993 or something when they moved out of Afghanistan. And when 9/11 happened, they said, oh, this was such a shock. We lost interest in Afghanistan. It's a bit like a drug dealer saying they lost their address book. You know, of course, that's not true. It's obviously not true. But the proof has now arisen in that, that the Osama bin Laden unit was discovered, leaked about 2 years after 9/11. So all through the debates that they had at the time of 9/11, when they were adamantly saying they were taken by surprise, they'd lost interest in Afghanistan, there were actually 80 CIA agents in a dedicated, top-secret Osama bin Laden unit running whatever they were running in the run-up to 9/11. Nobody even asked them, and most people don't even know the name of the guy who was in charge of it.
Now, some people listening will be thinking, how many conspiracy theories can they crash into the first 5 minutes of this programme? But look,
well, this isn't a theory. I don't say anything that's not based on official documents.
I mean, I asked you this question, but one of the things that first woke me up to the September the 11th attacks was a film by a guy called Dave Von Kleist, who was a radio host over in the United States, something called The Power Hour, and he'd been sent lots of footage from the various news channels, local TV news in New York and all over the United States, and that's what the thing he asked on his radio show. And I think this is something we can learn from, is that when you see one of these big attacks, immediately switch on your recorder and start to record the TV, the radio and everything, and then make copies of it and send it in to journalists so that we can pull things apart, because the government certainly isn't doing it. And here is Dave Von Kleist, because I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago and just asked him about this whole idea of as he was accused all the time of being a conspiracy theorist.
The first word that you can think of after you hear the word conspiracy, most people will say theory. And that's because we've all been trained to associate theory with conspiracy. So in other words, no conspiracies are real. They're all just theories. So let's define. What is a conspiracy theory? Conspiracy, by definition, is when two or more people plan something in secret. All right? Theory, by definition, is a supposition, a concept, an idea. For example, in theory, if I purchase a raffle ticket, I can win a prize. Now, once I purchase a raffle ticket, it's no longer a theory. It becomes a possibility. And the more raffle tickets that I purchase, the more possible and eventually probable the win becomes. And such is the case with a conspiracy theory. When you have no evidence to support the contention of a conspiracy, then indeed it is a conspiracy theory. But once you have a piece of evidence, no matter how flimsy or circumstantial it may be, the idea of a conspiracy becomes a possibility. And the more evidence that you amass to support the contention of a conspiracy, the more probable and eventually likely that conspiracy is. So if you apply that towards the official story, I remember that on September 18th, a week after the attacks on September 11th, Condoleezza Rice did a news conference, and she stated, and I'm paraphrasing, I might be quoting her word for word, she said, "We have definitive proof and evidence that links Osama bin Laden to the attacks on September 11th, and we will release this information in due time." Now, to this day, there has never been any information released or any evidence that proves or links Osama bin Laden to the September 11th attacks. So if you apply the official story to the term conspiracy theory, they charged Osama bin Laden with a conspiracy to destroy the Twin Towers and to attack America. However, they never provided any evidence to support that contention. So by definition, that means that the official story is a conspiracy theory, because they never provided any evidence to support it. So if the official story has no evidence to support the accusation against Osama bin Laden and the Taliban, however, there is a myriad of evidence that supports the idea that this was something other than an attack by Osama bin Laden, then we have to, you know, logic and common sense would dictate that we would have to look at all of the other evidence to find out what really happened. And anybody who has been looking at this evidence, like I said, for over a decade now, a decade and a half, has been labeled as a wacko, right-wing, extremist, this and that and everything, because they do not want a lot of this information brought into the public domain, into open conversation. They just don't want it, because the official story cannot hold water.
Is that true, Ian, that there's no link with Osama bin Laden?
Very little. Even the FBI chief said that he was amazed to find 2 years later that they actually couldn't find anything, though he said there was no paper trail, even after they investigated everything they found in Afghanistan. And now, actually, the official stories subtly change, like they do, without actually telling us. And the story now is that actually it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed who's conveniently in Guantanamo Bay and been tortured, according to most reports, very seriously over a very long period, and hence worthless as an as a witness. So yeah, it's changed. Osama bin Laden was just a sort of godfather at the back of it. They couldn't find any connection to him. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, oh dear, he turns out to be another a friend of the West. Robert Fisk in The Independent has written that he believes he was an agent of the Pakistani intelligence in the days when Pakistani intelligence used to work closely with the CIA. So the story keeps changing, and Martin is so right. There is literally, I think I'm right in saying, there is literally no major terrorist attack where the alleged culprits haven't already had contacts with the security services of the country concerned, and where that's initially been denied. And that includes 7/7, I believe.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Very, very close contacts, actually, between the Finsbury Park Mosque and Abu Hamza, and Haroon Aswat, MI6. John Loftus has alleged actually that Haroon Aswat was an MI6 double agent was the mastermind of the 7/7 attacks, and he was never put on trial. Yeah. Instead, he was sent over to the United States. So they said he was mad, put him in Broadmoor, sent him over to the US, and he is now in jail after being tried for something completely different to 7/7. So that was quite a convenient way of getting him out of the way. But Martin, this term conspiracy theory, a CIA weaponized term, number 1035-690. Well, that sounds like a conspiracy theory itself, but look it up. This is actually something which the CIA developed the term to use throughout the media, in other words, to get their agents in the press to start continually using this term after the Kennedy assassination.
That's right, because what was happening after the Kennedy assassination, various people were asking questions about it, and they were being called assassination theories, theories of how the assassination had taken place. You know, could the Oswald firing from the book depository have managed to do it, etc., all those kind of questions. And the CIA decided to use strategic communications, psychological warfare, and they pushed this idea of conspiracy theory, which by definition is wacko. Tinfoil hat, that phrase came out at the same time, and this was quite consciously pushed by the CIA. They told all of their acolytes in the media to pick up on this term and to use it, and it's still used as a means of controlling public debate about terrorism and other matters related to it.
Okay, so look up that number. It's 1035-960. If you stick that into your favourite search engine, definitely not necessarily Google, that's what you'll come out with. You'll see the evidence that actually this is a term. The media has been very, very important, and as we're seeing there from the use of this term conspiracy theory in spinning the line of what is the 9/11 attacks really all about. But can you take us through what actually happened, Ian?
Well, yeah, I mean, the official story holds that quite by surprise, a bunch of highly trained terrorists showed up in America. They hijacked four planes, 19 of them, got into four teams. They hijacked four different planes, and they flew them into the two twin towers of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And the fourth one, there's no great consensus. Some people think it was aimed at the Capitol, which would have made it practically turned America
That's
in
the White overnight. House.
The White House, the Congress, which would have turned America more or less overnight into a police state, no doubt about it, if it isn't already. But that plane was either crashed or some people think shot down. That's the official story. And pretty much every part of it is suspect. I'm not saying wrong, but they haven't produced the evidence. I mean, the most spectacular thing, of course, is the building collapses, where they still have not produced any peer-reviewed evidence that buildings can collapse in the way that those appeared to, with nothing more than relatively minor structural damage when you consider the size of the buildings, and relatively hot but not super hot fires.
Martin, what was, do you think, why are we still talking about it today, 16 years afterwards? I introduced it as a sort of, you know, almost like a young man coming of age. 16 years ago, this happened, and it's a lie, which is, many parts of which are now starting to actually take form and almost become part of the definition of what's happening in the 21st century.
It was obviously a epical event, and it, we're still talking about it because it's still very relevant to the situation we're in today. But interestingly enough, in the first few years after 9/11, the mainstream media banged on every year about it to remind us why we were going to war in Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And now, in fact, they're playing it down rather, because they know that more and more questions are being asked about it, and they'd rather that people just remember it as they want it to be remembered, and that, let's move on now with that history, let's not worry about it.
Opinion polls show that Britain, France, we did what Reinvestigate 9/11 did, an opinion poll through a, you know, a reputable, normal, well-known company, I forget which one, Mori, I think, and we found about 30% of people in the UK do not believe the official story and fundamentally don't believe it. They think it's seriously wrong. Same in France. 30% of people in France think the US government organised 9/11. Similar figures in the United States. A lot of people, you know, you might meet might be very surprised to hear that, because all the people they know, you know, they read The Guardian, watch the BBC, and they believe the official story, more establishment-minded. But that is what objective opinion polls have found. There's very widespread doubts about it, even in the West.
Some people have called the smoking gun of 9/11 Building 7, and this is one of the most clearly and obvious problems with the official story, is that, first of all, to a large extent, it doesn't feature in the official story, and then where it does, we see absolutely unbelievable stories attached to it. So why Building 7? Why have people said that this is the smoking gun, Ian?
Because it's now agreed that it fell at free fall acceleration for a part of its fall, as well as falling completely symmetrically. And the 9/11 sceptics are saying, well, that can't happen through any other way than controlled demolition. You cannot have a building failure where all the support fails within a millisecond of each other and symmetrically at the same time, which is what is required to make the official story work. As I mentioned earlier, there's been no peer-reviewed evidence produced to support the official story. There's just been claims from Washington investigators. And recently, the University of Alaska has come out and said, after our studies, they're saying, we can't find any way on our computer models that we could make this happen. So it's looking like it's pretty dodgy.
Well, also the Daily Express, which is about to be, looks like maybe taken over by the Mirror, I heard this morning. Says what the headline last year, what really sent it down? Shock report reveals 9/11 tower did not collapse due to fire. So there's certainly a question we can leave hanging in the air for a few minutes. But also there is another interesting aspect to all of this, and that is that Alaska University seems to have taken this whole question of what really happened at Building 7 on with a gusto, and they've started something called it's called WTC7 evaluation, and just literally this week have released a report which again throws more doubt upon the official story. They aren't necessarily saying it was controlled demolition, but that is what many people who look at the footage say.
Yeah, I mean, my first thought, you know, because I always like to think the best of people, was that maybe there was a gas main in the buildings, you know, which blew up, but there wasn't, you know, and nobody's really produced the sort of energy you need to create that sort of destruction. And these huge, huge skyscrapers, 47 stories high, WTC7, World Trade Center 110, the sort of forces you need to demolish those buildings are immense, and yeah, nobody can really see where they came from if it wasn't some sort of explosive. And there were reports. See, I mean, one thing that has been forgotten, I think, is the testimony of William Rodriguez, who was the head janitor in the buildings, the Twin Towers. He has no doubt at all that there were massive explosions in the basements of those buildings.
Okay,
at the
and it's not just him,
hit.
Though.
I would and suggest, there's many other
yeah,
people
I mean,
who corroborate
that's
that.
One of the best things, I think, in a way, about that film, In Plain Sight, I mentioned with Dave von Kleist earlier, which came out in 2004, is that he has, like, literally 2 minutes of TV, live TV coverage, where the live TV commentators are saying there are reports of explosions, we are hearing explosions, and that is something which is not really commensurate with collapsing buildings. But Martin, it's interesting, isn't it, that we've had quite a lot of academics now and architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth looking very closely at this.
Yeah, can I just repeat to people what WTC7 was? Because it was a third building that collapsed, and many people don't even realise that three buildings collapse. And of course, as Ian's pointed out, where is the energy to reduce buildings not to rubble but to dust? Dust. Fine particle dust.
What was it, a death ray?
Well, indeed, you've got to ask. I mean, and of course, there has been further studies by Nils Harrit and Steve Jones. Nils Harrit from Copenhagen University, Steve Jones from the University of Utah. They're chemists, and they've discovered in the rubble traces of nanothermite, which is an extremely powerful explosive. The only people who've got it are basically the United States military.
And it's called thermite because it gets extremely hot very fast.
Well, nanothermite is special because it's not even normal thermite, but they discovered it, and it's been peer reviewed in the chemistry journals.
Only the U.S. military, or with other people?
Well, it's going to be the U.S. military and their allies, maybe the British and the Israelis, but nobody else.
When you mentioned the U.S. military, let me just mention one part of the 9/11 attacks that I forgot to mention, and that is the anthrax attacks. Now, everybody was quite sure at the time that they were connected, and one reason for that was that these letters with anthrax spores and deadly anthrax spores that were sent out across America. One reason they thought that was because they had messages in them saying long live Allah and, you know, onward with jihad or whatever. Well, actually, it turned out that anthrax, on forensic analysis, and this is widespread, you know, this is agreed now by the mainstream media, that anthrax came out of a U.S. laboratory. It didn't come out of anywhere in Iraq or Afghanistan. And once that came out, suddenly they all forgot about the anthrax attacks. And the FBI reckon they found some rogue scientist who committed suicide. You can imagine the story, you know. But it did come out of a U.S. laboratory, that anthrax. And so, you know, why shouldn't the rest of 9/11 have come out of the US as well, some people are saying?
Absolutely right. Well, maybe. But anyway, look, before we leave Building 7 completely, I'd like to go back to the actual date of 9/11 itself. And it's probably the most embarrassing couple of minutes of TV footage the BBC have ever transmitted, because this was on BBC News 24. And their reporter was Jane Stanley. The amazing thing is, here she is reporting the collapse of the World Trade Center Building 7 several minutes. I'm not sure how many minutes. Do you know either of you two, before it actually happened?
It was about 20 minutes, wasn't
it? About 20 minutes before it happened. Now, since this time, the BBC have said, oh, well, we just got a report from Reuters. But then the question, of course, goes to Reuters.
Well,
how did Reuters know?
Matt Campbell, who's a very heroic guy, he lost his brother tragically in the World Trade Center, and he's been campaigning off and on ever since. He's been snubbed by his MP, won't even take up his case, won't answer his questions, snubbed by the local police. Anyway, Matt did get an answer from the BBC, which was... or at least from Reuters, and he said, well, you know, where was the source of this information, because it's pretty important. And Reuters said, oh, well, we can't remember. That's it. They can't remember the
source. Mainstream media, get your act together or get out of town. Anyway, let's have a listen to BBC World News 24 from September the 11th itself, and this incredible report of Building 7 collapsing 20 minutes before it really did.
Now, more on the latest building collapse in New York. You might have heard a few moments ago I was talking about the Salomon Brothers building collapsing. And indeed it has. Apparently that's only a few hundred yards away from where the World Trade Center towers were. And it seems that this was not a result of a new attack. It was because the building had been weakened during this morning's attacks. We'll probably find out more now about that from our correspondent, Jane Stanley. Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy. There's almost a sense downtown in New York behind me, down by the World Trade Centers, of just an area completely closed off as the rescue workers try to do their job. But this isn't the first building that has suffered as a result. We know that part of the Marriott Hotel next to the World Trade Center also collapsed as a result of this huge amount of falling debris from 110 floors walls of the two twin towers of the World Trade Center. As you can see behind me, the Trade Center appears to be still burning. We see these huge clouds of smoke and ash, and we know that behind that there's an empty piece of what was a very familiar New York skyline, a symbol of the financial prosperity of this city, but completely disappeared now, and New York is still unable to take on board what has happened to them today.
Well, unfortunately, I think we've lost the line with Jane Stanley in Manhattan. Perhaps we can rejoin her and follow that up later.
Sounds quite convincing, doesn't she? Sounds like she really does know what she's talking about.
They can do that. That's part of one of the skills of working for the mainstream media, isn't it? You say something with a certain authority. It's something to do with tone of voice, I think.
Oh, yes, it's been weakened. That was the reason there. And then, of course, she gets cut off, having announced to the world that something's happened that's about to be planned to happen in a few 30 minutes' time. I can also remember in the Press Gazette, which was the weekly magazine, it used to be anyway, for journalists. I think it's gone online only now. There was a review of the BBC's reply to that assertion that, oh, it was just a bit of confusion, nothing more than that. And the correspondent, I can't remember who it was, but the correspondent discussing it wasn't convinced at all by the BBC editor's reply, and they said, pull the other one, lizard man. Wow. So that, I think, sums it up. Anyway, the Press Gazette, not long after that, was bought up by another company, and it's never really quite been the same since. And so, Martin, again, we come back to this whole thing of the press spinning it, and when the press starts to explain to journalists and the public that we're being lied to, it seems that organ, that particular part of the press, gets closed down, in that case anyway. Or at least taken over.
Daily Mirror was taken over by some New York financiers. They said the one thing we're not going to do is interfere editorially, and then they sacked Piers Morgan a year or two later because of his editorial.
Yeah, I mean, the mainstream media are very important in all of this, because if you are a criminal cabal inside the state carrying out attacks like this, and of course there's a track record of NATO intelligence services engaging in this false flag terrorism, as it's called, going back to the 1940s. So, for example,
do you want to just explain that term, false flag?
Well, false flag originally came about because in naval warfare in the 18th and 19th centuries, some ships, and the Battle of San Nazaire, for example, in the Second World War, the British commandos flew a German flag as they move towards the dock.
And of course, that's against the rules of war, is it?
It's against the rules of war, but it's the sort of thing that used to happen and still does happen. So that's where the term false flag came from. But of course, what we're really talking about here is terrorist attacks like those that happened in Italy during the 70s and the 80s, which police investigation have proved beyond a shadow of a doubt were carried out by the intelligence services of NATO. And that's said by Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who was one of the main investigators of all these incidents that went on in Italy in that era. And in other words, 9/11 didn't come out of a blue sky. NATO intelligence services have been engaging in this kind of manipulation for quite a long while.
And then, of course, we've got the issue of the sort of what you might say the period of the political planning of 9/11 in the years up to 9/11, when they realised they didn't have an enemy any longer in the form of the Soviet Union. So they said, well, we're going to make drugs and terrorism our enemies. This was all very openly discussed. Nobody thought it was that significant at the time, because it seemed very important.
Is this the neocons we're talking about here?
Well, no, we're talking about the mainstream, American Washington mainstream, UK mainstream. Remember, the UK has a huge interest in its strategic strategy of keeping America looking outwards and involved in the rest of the world. That is our plan for, and we piggyback on America. And if America's risking turning and looking inward, which it did look as if would happen in the 90s with the alleged Soviet threat over, there was a huge amount of fear that America, in Washington, London, all across NATO, that America would just lose interest in fighting wars abroad. And that was discussed very widely. They had a commission in America called the Hart-Rudman Commission, which decided that terrorism must be seen as being a huge number one enemy. That reported just before, 6 months before 9/11.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because a big ally of the United States is Israel, and of course a lot of the effect of 9/11 has been in the Middle East. And Benjamin Netanyahu in the 1980s actually wrote a book. Actually, I think he only just did one chapter, but this book was edited by Netanyahu, and it was called Terrorism, How the West Can Win.
Yeah. Well, we certainly won through the using terrorism.
So. Anyway, also, I mean, one of the things I quite often hear is, well, if this was an inside job of some sort, surely there would be whistleblowers.
Well, there are. But you've got to remember, whistleblowers, they can only testify to what they know, because otherwise they're going to be called conspiracy theorists, as discussed earlier. So you're never going to get a whistleblower who's going to say, well, I can tell you what the whole plan of 9/11 was, because there might only be half a dozen people on the planet who know that. Because what you have to understand, I was discussing this with the Daily Mail actually this week, is compartmentalization. That is just inherent in any intelligence operation. You know, if people put explosives in the World Trade Center, they would have thought it was to protect against some sort of disaster. They wouldn't have been told, oh, well, we're going to have a false flag terrorist operation. So, you know, when Colleen Rowley, FBI agent in chief in Minneapolis, gets up and says, well, I can testify that the CIA and the FBI headquarters refused our request to arrest some of these alleged hijackers, which would have stopped 9/11. When she says that, she can't say any more than that. She can't say, and I think it was part of a plot, because they'll start laughing at her. But if you add up the various whistleblowers, then you find that, you know, depending on what you call a whistleblower, you find that there's a pretty strong consensus, you know, around the theory that the official story is wrong.
But one whistleblower goes by the name of Barry Jennings, and he was in World Trade Center Building 7, wasn't he, Martin? And he said that he was in there, and he only just about managed to get out. But he was actually an official working for the Port Authority, and he gave a couple of interviews, but then he died very suddenly. Well,
not long
quickly,
after being interviewed by the BBC Conspiracy Files programme. And when I appeared in a public event, with me and the guy who did the conspiracy files, I was told unofficially before the program that the one thing he wouldn't discuss was his interview with Barry Jennings, which took place not long at all before Jennings was apparently died of a heart attack. He was a senior guy, very credible guy. He wasn't just an ordinary sort of random eyewitness.
Yeah, and he was actually working for them. Anyone else you'd like to point to, Martin, as regards whistleblowers? Or maybe we can even move on to some of the people that have made a real difference over the last 16 years in getting the word out. I know the first person I actually read material from about the 9/11 attacks was a guy called Thierry Masson. I'd never heard of him before.
Yes, well, he's a very well-known French journalist, and he's based in Damascus.
Well, I haven't ever seen him on Newsnight or anything like that.
No, you wouldn't go in there.
Well, can I tell you, somebody who's very important that the listeners need to understand is General Leonid Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11.
But it's more interesting looking at the Americans, surely, because the Russians would say that, wouldn't they?
Well, no, they wouldn't.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, someone like Stubblebine, for example, he's actually a US general.
Stubblebine is the highest ranking US military figure to have questioned the story. And of course there are others. There is a very good website which I think is called Military
Patriots Question 9/11.
No, it's the Military and Intelligence Question 9/11. I can't remember what the exact title of the website is. It's just gone from my mind. But basically it's got hundreds of US military officers who have to be officers. They're not just enlisted men, and they all question the story. But can I just come back on the Ivashov question? The Russians have a massive intelligence gathering operation which he would have been at the centre of. And he is basically very calmly, if you look at this material, people can look him up, he's very calmly saying, we're not buying this. We're just not buying it.
One of the other big figures is a guy called David Ray Griffin. I think he's become maybe one of the most respected in the United States. He's certainly sold, hate to say it, Ian, but probably more copies
more
of his book than
me,
you.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, what do you rate him?
No, he's great. He's got a different style from me. I write in a journalistic style, and he sort of is a bit more polemical. He's making a case. He gives you the points. And he makes his case, you know, most people think who've read him.
I prefer to report,
you know, what people are saying rather than particularly make a case one way or the other.
He's just come out with a new book, actually, David Ray Griffin, and it's called Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. How's that for a cheery title? But I think he's saying that there is information coming out all the time about the September the 11th attacks, and much of it has been missed. And one of the things he's trying to do with these books, as he brings new books out, is to make sure that there's almost a chapter by chapter, okay, here's another 200 pages of evidence as to why they're lying to us. But anyway, here is an interview just from a couple of weeks ago by a guy called John Such in the US at KBOO radio station in Portland with David Ray Griffin about this book. And one of the things he focuses on is the movements of Dick Cheney on the day.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the new things in the book is about Cheney. According to the official story, he was in his office and then he was taken downstairs by the Secret Service, but he didn't really get into the room down there till I think it was 9:58. Well, the fact was that Cheney went down there very early. The mainstream press pretty much ignored all the evidence, including one member of the cabinet who said, no, Dick Cheney was down there certainly before 9:30 and certainly before the Pentagon was struck. But the reason for the lie about this was that that way they could claim that Cheney could not have been responsible for the attack on the Pentagon. Well, in the book, I've summarized new evidence that showed that there were at least three major statements by members of the Secret Service who were there and involved in 9/11 who said that Cheney was into the room before 9:30. I mean, this is a blockbuster story potentially for the press to say his story about 9/11 that shows that Cheney lied and the 9/11 Commission lied about where Cheney was. And this has been available for over a year, and you not have a single mainstream report about this. It all goes back to empire. These are all things to support America's dominance of the world, and therefore of its natural resources.
I'm also a member of Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth, and part of my reason was I just felt we've been blaming the wrong people for a horrendous crime. And if there's anything that is a sin throughout all of our religious traditions, it certainly is bearing false witness.
You know, it's the greatest false flag operation ever, both in terms of the size of the operation and in the size of the effects. So that's another way of describing what my book is about. What have been the effects of the 9/11 false flag attacks?
Well, there's another group for you, Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth. We've heard about Martin and his military leaders, but I think it's fair to say that people like Richard Gage and Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth have been some of the real spearhead, I suppose, of the official response to the attacks, Ian.
Well, there's two sides to this, basically, if you distill it. There's the forensic side, which is how did the towers come down, what happened to the plane that seems to have vanished at the Pentagon, some people say, that sort of side of it. And then you've got what I would call the paper trail side, which is the alleged hijackers were being protected by the CIA and financed by the Saudis. That's something we haven't really touched on yet. But this is very big in America. There's a guy in the New York Post who's provided the most devastating evidence that the Saudi government was, in a sense, behind 9/11.
But that's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? Especially since the Saudis and the Americans have got a very important strategic and financial connection.
Well, it's not only strategic and financial, but who was it who blocked the FBI from arresting those Saudi-supported hijackers? Not the Saudis. They can't block investigations in America. It was the CIA. It was our friends at the Osama bin Laden unit, which nobody even knew about at the time of 9/11. 2 years later, the Daily Telegraph broke the news, and they mentioned also very significantly that the Osama bin Laden unit was a secret unit, and it was in secret premises. It wasn't even a CIA, because of course the first reaction of anybody in the CIA, if you mention this to them, is they'll say, oh well, you couldn't keep it secret. That's the other thing we we've all heard so many times, isn't it? You couldn't keep it secret. Well, maybe that's why they put the Osama bin Laden in a top secret unit in a top secret location. We still don't know what that location was, but we do know from the 9/11 Commission report, reading between the lines, they never admitted it in so many words, that there were about 80 people in that team. 80.
Experts speak out, Martin. This is a film, last year I think it came out, certainly within the last couple of years. It's really pretty devastating evidence from professional architects and professional engineers about the collapse of the World Trade Center.
Yes, and I think even if you're not a specialist, you can ask yourself a simple question. If three skyscrapers can collapse into their own footprints and be reduced not to rubble but to dust by fires, then maybe we should not be building buildings like this at all. Why haven't we closed down all the skyscrapers? Why, you know, you'd think that's what you'd
do. This is where we go to Grenfell Tower,
of course. Yes, Grenfell Tower burned for hours, but it didn't collapse. And in fact, there's been a number of fires in skyscrapers since then, all over the world. There was one in Madrid that burned for 2 days, I think. And the skyscrapers are designed not to collapse when they're on fire.
I think we can give you... you know, a bit of an exclusive here. There's a secret war going on in the Fire Brigades Union around this very issue. Mm-hmm. Because a year or two before Grenfell Tower, 9/11 truthers in the Fire Brigades Union, of which there are quite a few and increasingly many now, they said, hang on, if the official story of 9/11 is true, the authorities have behaved as if it's not true, because the policy is still to stay put in a fire. And if it's true that buildings can collapse just like that, just because of a fire, then the policy should be not to actually get people out as quickly as possible. Fire Brigades Union executive, out of political correctness and not wanting to get the CIA and who else on their backs, refused to discuss this. And now, as a result, you could say indirectly, you know, we had the disaster in Grenfell Tower, where still people were told to stay rather than get out.
Well, let's move on to talk about some of the potential motives. Maybe you first, Martin. What do you think's the motives? We heard a little bit, didn't we, from David Ray Griffin there.
Well, I think it's pretty... I mean, if you look at the past history of false flag attacks by NATO intelligence services, going back to the... what was it called? The... In 1964, the Northwoods... Operation Northwoods,
yeah.
It's people can look this up quite straightforwardly these days. You can check any of the things we're saying on this show. Operation Northwoods was a plan by Lyman Lemnitzer, who is the head of the U.S. military.
Oh, and Bilderberger, by the way.
It was signed off by all the U.S. military
chiefs. It's a small world, isn't it?
And basically, what the plan was, there were going to be hijackings of planes, and there were going to be bombs going off. Lots of people would seem to have been killed inside the United States. They would then blame Cuba for everything that had happened and invade Cuba. And there's a whole plan written down, which was passed to Kennedy and to Robert McNamara, his sidekick, to and they just threw it back at them and said, we're not doing that, that's crazy. But in other words, there's a long history...
And then, hang on, because you missed out... Then Kennedy was assassinated.
Well, yeah. That subsequently happened. I presume most of our listeners will know that. But the fact is that Operation Gladio, for example, in Western Europe in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and up to now, there is overwhelming evidence that NATO has engaged in false flag terrorism long before 9/11. The Bologna bombing was in 1980. The Italian police investigated that and they came to an absolutely firm conclusion that their own intelligence services were behind the bombing, which killed 86 people. So it was a bigger bombing than the 7/7 bombings in London. And that's proven. Nobody's ever been arrested. Nobody's ever been put on trial. And because nobody's ever been arrested or put on trial for these things, we can presume that they're still active within the intelligence services. And so when we think of MI5 and MI6 and CIA, they are not there to protect the people. They're just not. They haven't been for years.
Before we hear from Ian Henshaw on what he thinks the motives for September the 11th attacks really were, let's have a go back again to Dave von Kleist, who did this film back in 2004 called 9/11 in Plain Sight, and who's a radio host doing a regular radio show over in the United States for many years, and he was one of the first people, I suppose, that turned me and others, many others, onto the so-called conspiracy theories. Actually, really, what we are is conspiracy scholars. We know it was a conspiracy. We're just trying to work out exactly who, how, and why. But what does he think about what the motives were?
Now, if you turn the clock back to, say, 1999, let's ask ourselves the question, how many world powers were there? Well... Russia had collapsed back in the 80s, so that wasn't really a threat anymore. China was the U.S. biggest trading partner. So of all the world powers out there, which one of them posed a threat to the United States? What the answer is, none of them. So, okay, let's keep that idea in mind. Then ask yourself the question, what is the biggest business in the world? Some people would come back and say the oil business. Some people would say big pharma. Okay. The point is that the biggest business includes all of them, because the biggest business in the world is the military-industrial complex, military contracting. If you look at the situation back in the late 90s, in 99, the United States lusts for war. I mean, 52% of our federal budget in this country goes towards the military-industrial complex, and people are making obscene amounts of money by military contracts. So the point is that if there's no threat of military action or conflict in the world, these people are not feeling very financially secure. Okay, so if you put that idea in the back burner, now let's add something else. Back in 99, the Trade Center was owned by the Port Authority. The Port Authority had been informed by the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, that the World Trade Center's buildings were dirty buildings. In other words, they were loaded with asbestos. They were built in the late 60s, early 70s, and the only way to remove asbestos is to strip the building right down to its girders and sandblast this stuff off. You can't do it like, say, 5 or 10 floors at a time. The whole building has to be done. So it would not have been cost effective to both of those towers down to their girders and then rebuild them. It's just impossible to do. Financially impossible. So then the EPA had told them, say, hey, look, if it's not done within 10 years, we're going to have to condemn it and shut the building down. So, number one, military contractors lust for war. Number two, there's no threat of war in the late 90s. Number three, the EPA had told the Port Authority that they had to do something about these buildings. Okay? So, number four, if the military-industrial complex lusts for war and there's no prospect for war, how can they generate a war? Okay? Do you see where we're going with this? We're looking for a motive. We're looking for opportunity. Okay? The point is that the powers that be had the motive to destroy these buildings. There's no way they could have brought them down like they do in Las Vegas after a hotel has outlived its usefulness, or someplace in the country where a sports stadium has to be brought down, or an apartment building. They hire a controlled demolition company and bring it down. But they couldn't do that in New York. I mean, we're talking Wall Street. If anybody's ever been to Wall Street, you know how congested and how close together all these buildings are. There's no way that the Trade Center could be raised or blown up and brought down. So what were they going to do? How could they possibly get rid of these two towers that have turned into albatrosses? Oh, there's another factor to put into this. According to William Rodriguez, who was working the Trade Center for 20 years, 35% of the office space was vacant. So the Trade Center was losing millions and millions and millions of dollars every month. So they're losing money. They've got a dirty building. They lust for war. How many other motivating factors do you need to motivate somebody to have a false flag and blame it on the Middle East and justify a move into the Middle East? You put that together with another issue that happened back in 2000 before George W. Bush was elected president, was the Project for the New American Century. This was a think tank that consisted of Paul Bremer, Wolfowitz, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, of course George Bush, all of the same cabal that was in the administration. And they said in that document, it said that they wanted to be able to control the Middle Eastern oil, but they needed an excuse to go into the Middle East, and it would be nothing other than, and I quote, a Pearl Harbor type of an event to justify military action. So I realize that a lot of this information, a lot of these points that I'm making are circumstantial. None of it is hard evidence. But if you put them all together, you come up with some very strong motivation to want these towers to be destroyed. But they couldn't do it legally. They couldn't do it in the open. So how would they do it? Well, how convenient. We'll have a terrorist attack, blow the buildings up and blame it on the Middle East, and that'll give us a justification to launch a war.
That's Dave von Kleist again there. Ian Henschel, also, he mentioned the idea of New Pearl Harbor. That's also the book, isn't it? One of the first, in fact, the first big book by David Ray Griffin. This is a New Pearl Harbor, the idea being that if America's under threat like it was in 1941 with the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor, suddenly the people will do almost anything.
Yeah, well, if throughout the whole of the Second World War, you know, if you said, why are we bothering to talk about Pearl Harbor? People would have thought you were crazy. That's why we were in the war. And unfortunately, with 9/11, the war's gone on for 15 years. And the reason we're talking about 9/11 is because that's why we're in this war, basically. And they keep on using it. You know, I think the reason a lot of us got involved with campaigning for the truth here was because we could see that they were going to be using this for a long time. You know, this wasn't going to be an issue that was going to go away anytime soon.
Martin, a lot of the mainstream left, for example, the Stop the War Coalition, for example, don't really think that 9/11 is important.
Well, I think what you're going to find is something like the Stop the War Coalition is an anti-war coalition. Let's just say the official story is true and a bunch of people in a cave in Afghanistan brought these buildings down. That still doesn't justify invading Iraq and killing millions of people. It just doesn't.
Yeah.
So you've got to separate the two things out. People don't have to believe all the things we're talking about to oppose war. War's wrong. War's evil. We don't need war.
You know what, it's a bit like the climate change argument, isn't it? Where you say, well, I don't have to believe in climate change to know that we need less cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So we shouldn't attack people. If people are opposed to war, that's fine. I mean, they don't have to believe all the things we're talking about. If they're opposed to war, that's good in itself. But, of course, the real problem is that this is... You know, this has been done quite deliberately to create a war, and it's a war without end. Unlike the Second World War, which had a definite end, this has got no end. It's going to go on forever.
The Second World War was 6 years, wasn't it? 6 years long, and we've had what's that? Nearly three Second World Wars now.
I think where I would take issue with some people on the left, particularly the mainstream left, somebody like George Monbiot, sadly, I think he sadly discredited himself with his savage attack on the 9/11 truth movement, which unfortunately most Guardian readers wouldn't have known was based on pretty much totally incorrect facts.
Well, many of his Guardian readers don't know that his father was the vice chairman of the Conservative Party.
I didn't know that.
But anyway, reinvestigate 9/11.
I run it nowadays with lots of help from some great people. Roy Hunter, I don't know how many to mention. I should have got their permission perhaps before. So I'm the public face of it. Yeah, we're the British version of the 9/11 truth movement, we'd like to think. You know, we've got a website, reinvestigate911.org. You can sign up to our newsletter. You won't get bombarded just a few times a year, probably. And we've got a demo outside the BBC on Monday in Portland's place in London. We're hoping to get some coverage.
Surely you should be trying to persuade the BBC on side rather than having a go at them.
Well, we've tried.
Is there not going to be a documentary on the BBC exposing some of this?
No, they won't. I mean, the demand is that they should correct the information, vitally important information that they put out in their Conspiracy Files programmes, which turned out to be absolutely false. They expressly denied that World Trade Center 7 collapsed at free fall speed because, of course, they could see that was game, set and match to the to us. If they were to admit that. But since then, Washington's been forced to admit that. They haven't taken any notice of the implications, but they have been forced to admit it. But the BBC still won't. BBC have acted as, I'm afraid to say, launderers for the official story.
We'll be back after the Murdoch News at 6.
Bubbling over with!
Is there a conspiracy? Yes. Are we being manipulated and controlled and guided into a new world order and a new world religion? Yes. Is there a group in charge of this who's been in charge all along who are bringing this about? Yes. And I can tell you, folks, they're as old as man. They're the followers of an ancient religion that has persisted even unto this day.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, 9/11 16th anniversary special, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, author Ian Henshaw, and me, Tony Gosling. And joining us on the line, I'm hoping now, from the United States, is Chris Bolin. Hi, Chris, and welcome to the politics show. Can you hear me, Chris? Yeah, so it doesn't sound like we've got a very good link to Chris Bolin there, which is a pity. But maybe, Martin, you could help us out here a little bit, because Chris has made quite a lot of links between the Israelis and 9/11. And there's quite a lot of people around the world who are saying, well, actually, that's just anti-Semitic. You have to be a Nazi to say things like that.
Well, the fact is, were they connected to it, yes or no? And the answer is yes, and there's quite strong evidence. For example, the five dancing Israelis who were seen celebrating when the first plane hit the first tower, and they were seen and the on the top of a white van, and somebody noticed them and took the van's registration number, gave it to the police. 8 hours later, the van was stopped, they were arrested. And it turned out that they were Mossad agents, the people in the van, and that they were filming the attack. They were interrogated by the American authorities for several weeks, and eventually they got back to Israel and they went on television in Israel and said, yes, we were Mossad and we were filming the attack, but it was nothing suspicious, we were just documenting what was happening. Documenting a supposed surprise attack on the United States of America. And that's one link to the potential involvement of Israel and the Mossad in 9/11.
Well, there's another one, isn't there? And that's that quite a lot of people involved in the subsequent cover-up and the investigation were dual US-Israeli citizens.
That's true. And you've got... If you think about we're talking about motive before the break, there's two big motives. So the US military industrial complex needs enemies because they need money, and the Israelis have got a plan to balkanize the Middle East, the Yinon plan, and they need the Americans and the British as well as junior partners to help them dominate the Middle East. So we've got a fairly straightforward explanation.
Shortly before 9/11, Israel was an absolute low point in its global popularity. Colin Powell walked out, the American Secretary of State walked out of a UN meeting in protest against the fact that they wouldn't buy the sort of support for Israel any longer. 3 months later, after 9/11, it was game, set and match to Israel politically. They were sending experts around, so-called experts around, helping practically every government in the world deal with terrorism. They went from the bad guys to the good guys overnight. Huge benefits for them.
Also, the Israelis are very, very keen on sort of high-tech stuff, aren't they? Particularly software.
They are. I mean, and in actual fact, all of the airports where the planes took off from on 9/11 were... most people may not realise this, but there's a huge private security industry out there that runs airports, but it's not actually controlled by the governments of the countries concerned where the airports are. So ICCS is an Israeli-based security company closely linked to the Mossad, although it's a private company, and they control all three airports on 9/11 in terms of getting people on and off planes, and they also control Schiphol Airport, where the underpants bomber was let onto the plane without going through security, because we got eyewitnesses saying that, and the shoe bomber also, Richard Wright, or whatever his name
was, Richard
Reed, got on at Schiphol. Don't forget that this war on terror is a huge boondoggle for private security companies, and who's the experts on trying to stop terrorism in the whole world? Oh, it's the Israelis. So they then get the contracts. But of course, if they are actually perpetrators, then being in charge of security in airports, I mean, you'd think, if you're a terrorist, why would you want to attack an airport? Well, it's full of security.
It's interesting, isn't it, that Chris Bolin, when he tried to come to speak on Ken O'Keefe's show on the David Icke channel, something called The People's Voice, which ran for a while until they ran out of money and there were various factional infighting going on there. This is back in January 2014. Chris Bolin was stopped at the airport and told that he wouldn't be allowed to enter the country because there was some sort of outstanding warrant for him in the United States. So he was sent back home. He wasn't allowed to come on that program. But it almost seems like this whole security industry, they seem to be working hand in hand. And to actually stop him coming into the UK to go on the TV, of course, that doesn't stop him talking on Skype, although he hasn't been able to talk on Skype today with us, unfortunately, when we're in the new studio. It's the first time we've used Skype in here, so there may be some other problem with it. But this whole private security industry, and it's not just private security, it's also the private arms industry and private military companies have absolutely exploded as part of this war on terror. In fact, many of these troops, the Americans a couple of weeks ago said they're sending 4,000 new troops to Afghanistan. Many of those will be effectively mercenaries.
That's right.
I've got to say that I've got a slightly different model of this. I would see whoever carried out the 9/11 attacks or, you know, planned it as being a criminal conspiracy. I think that's really the best way politically to go forward on this. We've just been infiltrated by a team of criminals who've unfortunately managed to bully you.
But do you not buy this sort of geopolitical angle of the disruption of the Middle East?
What's happened over
such a long time.
I think that what we're talking about is a fairly small number of people who probably go to your Bilderberg group, you know, maybe the plot was hatched there, but in a country, a state or a golf course, I don't know, but we're talking about a small number of people who orchestrated this, and we've got our suspects list. But what you find, actually, interestingly, is that there's like almost like one person from each agency. You've got the Israelis, you can find links there, you can find links with the Pakistani intelligence, you can find links with the CIA, a lot of links with the CIA, with the Saudis. So what I think we're really looking at is a network, a sort of mafia-type network, and in just the same way as drugs networks have their man in the police tipping them off, this network has its... They want somebody everywhere important. And I don't think really the upper level of global power is nation-based. I think it's network-based. And these are what people known as the neocons. I mean, that's the whole point about the neocons. They could be Israeli, they could be British, they could be Washington people. So, yes, Israel hugely benefited and undoubtedly will have helped, but had prior knowledge. But does that mean they organized it entirely themselves? I couldn't say that.
Martin, what about the bigger talking about geopolitics? Is the links? If you look at these big power blocks around the world, one of the effects of the war on terror has been it's been very much more difficult for countries to be independent under this kind of new global war on terror. We found many Eastern European countries, for example, the coup in the Ukraine. Countries are just simply not allowed to be halfway between East and West. They have to make a decision. We're now settling out into effectively three main power blocks. I don't know if you could critique, I may be wrong here, but it looks to me like the Western Europe and the United States as one, you've got China as another, with the Russians as another, kind of sandwiched in the middle, and pretty much everybody is got an alliance with one or the other of those three major groups.
Yeah, and the Russians and the Chinese are being pushed together by the belligerent attitude of the Western neoconservatives in power. I think, to comment on what Ian's just saying, I think, yes, it's clearly a criminal network, and that's a very important political thing to get hold of, because, of course, Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, is basically saying, look, we've just got to arrest these people and put them on trial. And that's what we want. We want the people who did this, we want them arrested and we want them put on trial.
And we want a very thorough investigation into the ancillary people gave them...
That's
aid
right.
and comfort after this, and I'm afraid to say that's a lot of people in the mainstream media.
Well, that's right, but I mean, all of that's got to be dealt with, and but of course, ultimately, warfare is warfare. I'm pretty convinced that the Chinese and the Russians are know virtually everything we know about this. Don't forget, they've got far more resources to find this stuff out than we have as independent investigators, and they are trying to negotiate with the criminals that run the Western powers, and they're trying to sort of box them into a corner where they're made to back down without a full-scale war. But the danger of full-scale war is definitely there. I mean, we could be at war with Korea this week. That's how dangerous this situation
is. There's an interesting parallel with the Watergate scandal, where President Nixon, Republican president, was deposed or forced to resign, and most people took it that he was forced there by the left, who objected to the war in Vietnam. But what the Russians said, interestingly, was that he was actually being removed because he'd sought détente with the Russians, which he had done. There's no debate about that. And they thought the motive actually came from the right. And when Deep Throat was finally identified, the informant was... I mean, he was always convicted on the basis of CIA-released tape recordings. That's what nailed Nixon, the Watergate tapes. But later, you know, it turned out that it was the Deep Throat actually was a guy on the right in the FBI. He thought Nixon wasn't conservative enough. So, you know, that shows how the Russians... And now, I think, with hindsight, we'd probably mostly think that the Russian version is quite likely to be true. So, yeah, you know, they're pretty well... They shouldn't be taken... they shouldn't be laughed at, that's for sure.
One of the things that I noticed you did with your 9/11 network was you let them know that this show was going on, Ian. And one of the questions that came back from one of your people as part of the Reinvestigate 9/11 group, Pat Bernstein, or Bernstein, I'd probably mispronounce it there, is what she's saying, I'm not sure whether Pat is a man or a woman, how do you open people's minds to the possibility? There's so much complex evidence that needs to be presented. What simple non-technical points can be used to open the eyes of those who've got no concept of what happened on 9/11? Actually, I'm going to ask you if you can sum up maybe three or four points, you first, Ian, and then you, Martin.
Well, I would mention Operation Northwoods. Most people decide first what they want to believe and then find, I'm sorry to say this, and then find the evidence to fit it. I mean, we all do to some extent.
Well, some would say the same about you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'd say we all do to some extent. So I think what you really need to challenge are people's blocks. You know, there's no point in hitting them with immense amounts of evidence. The block is... They wouldn't do it. Well, the answer to that's Operation Northwoods. They'd be sure to get caught. Well, the answer to that's compartmentalisation. There'd be some whistleblowers. The answer to that is there are whistleblowers. They just haven't been reported in the mainstream media. So I think those are the three. And then the anthrax attacks, which, you know, were blamed on Al-Qaeda, but actually turned out to come out
of the
American...
One of the most interesting whistleblowers is this guy called Peter Ketchum, isn't he? Because he worked for the official investigators, the National Institute of Science and Technology.
Did Kevin Ryan as well. He's another very important whistleblower. Peter Ketchum has produced an extremely persuasive video. His detractors will say that he wasn't actually personally involved in the actual investigation, which I think is probably true, but he does have a great deal of knowledge of how NIST works, and he's explained effectively how NIST could have been nobbled, because a lot of people in the scientific world will tell you that NIST, which carried out these official investigations, is a totally respectable and trustworthy body, and most of the time they are quite trustworthy. But Peter Ketchum, as an insider in NIST, explains how they would have set up, and once again, of course, it's compartmentalization. They chose some hand-picked investigators and kept them away from everybody else, just what Dick Cheney did in the CIA to justify the Iraq war, and possibly also his modus operandi if it was Cheney who did the organizing for 9/11.
Jamie McPhail is also one on your list, mentions the anthrax attacks again.
Yeah.
And he says another aspect of this which hasn't really been looked at is the death of a guy called Bruce Ivins, and I'm not sure
Absolutely.
Who he is.
Well, he was framed by... I think it's, you know, not an exaggeration to say that he was framed by the FBI. When they couldn't get away from the fact that the anthrax came out of the US military-industrial complex, the next thing to do was to blame it on an individual rather than the conspiracy. So they found this poor guy, Bruce Ivins, bullied him into basically committing suicide. But interestingly, his colleagues are standing by him, and there's an immense amount of evidence that Bruce Ivins couldn't have done it, even if he'd wanted to. He just didn't have the right access to the anthrax laboratories. So, you know, but yeah, Jamie McPhail's absolutely right about that. It's a smoking gun, I think.
And he's saying that scientists that actually work with Bruce say that there's absolutely no way that he could have done it.
Exactly.
That, of course, has not been reported by the BBC, which is why maybe you're quite right to be outside there banging on their door. After all, if we don't pay the BBC licence fee, we get put in jail.
Yeah.
Well, we can do.
Well, Matt Campbell's not paying his. But Tony Rook. No, you'd be surprised how they're unwilling to create martyrs by sending anybody to jail, actually, on the issue.
Another question that's come up here is from Larry Jarbo, and he's saying, what do you think is the best way to put pressure on TV stations, etc.? He's asking me as well. I mean, I would suggest one of the ways you can do it is simply by having personal contacts with journalists. But what seems to be happening right across the Western press, and I mean, this is a whole other subject maybe, but is that honest journalists seem to be being sacked, being gotten rid of when they start to approach this kind of subject and start to try and deal with it.
Oh yeah, I mean, the battlefield's littered with journalists who, I mean, James Whale, you know, is a very aggressive talk show host. I was on one of his shows on TalkSport a few years ago, and you know, he's struggled to find a home.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Dave Von Kleist, we heard from earlier, he used to be on the old GCN network, which the Alex Jones and InfoWars are still on there. And then there's also George Butler, a guy in Austin, Texas, that does a program called The Secret Truth. He was also on that syndicated GCN network. As soon as he started to, he actually did an interview with Miko Peled, who was the son of one of the Israeli generals who were being very critical of the Israeli-US policy in the Middle East. All of a sudden he's told, well, sorry, your show is just boring, we're going to have to get rid of it now. But anyway, moving on to...
Well, when David Ray Griffin, I mean, this was spectacular, actually, because finally CNN were prepared to broach this. It had come up on their entertainment section, and they were overwhelmed by 9/11 skepticism when they raised it, and then they went stone dead on it 3 days later, and the executive said they'd been ordered to stop talking about it. Well, then they had one of their controversial panelist type people, hosts, called David Ray Griffin in, and literally she was sacked that day. They literally stopped it at about 48 hours notice, and they just to stop David Ray Griffin getting onto mainstream TV. That's how nervous they are.
Well, it reminds me of Discovery Channel and Conspiracy of Silence, which was a film made by Tim Tate, who's a British documentary producer, about paedophile rings in the United States in Washington, and the Republican Party, rather similar to our whole VI paedophile scandal. They actually paid $500,000 for the film, and then at the end of the day, they never showed it. But Martin, anyway, let's move on to Martin. What are your maybe three or four main points?
Okay. Well, we've covered one of them earlier, which is the WTC7 building. Most people don't realise that three buildings collapsed, and that building was not hit by a plane. It wasn't. There was no plane fire. So that's the first point. The second point I'd like to say to people is this: where was the United States Air Force for several hours on that day? Well, they
had exercises, but
don't forget, in the Battle of Britain, when in the 1940s, it took, you know, what, 30 minutes for the RAF to get airborne?
Quite a lot less than that, about five minutes.
Well, exactly. Minutes, yeah. So where was the Air Force? And, of course, we've never been given a satisfactory explanation for that. We know what happened. They were given a stand-down order.
Those planes were flying around for an hour and three quarters, weren't they?
Yes, exactly. Now, so those two... And the third point, I think of the context. And I'll just mention one word in terms of context: Gladio. G-L-A-D-I-O. You can just put it into any search engine and it will come up. And of course, there is overwhelming evidence put together by the Italian police force, by the Belgian police force, by Swiss academics, nobody really disputes this as a historian, that NATO intelligence services were involved in exactly this kind of false flag terrorism in the 40s, 50s and 60s in Western Europe, including the Brabant massacres in Belgium, where people in supermarkets were shot at random, and also bombing the Bologna railway station in 1980, the kidnap of Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister of Italy, all according to the Italian police force and 30 years of investigation carried out by NATO intelligence services.
In a slightly different area, I mean, of course, Hitler's invasion of Poland was based on the allegation that Poland was invading Germany.
I was in Dresden last year, and there are still Germans who believe that. They
really
still believe that Poland did invade. And actually, it was reported in the New York Times that Poland had invaded Germany.
Was it really?
Do you want to just talk about that incident, that about Gleiwitz they took Polish concentration camp victims, didn't they? People who were in concentration camps who were Polish, dressed them up in army Polish stolen Polish army uniforms, and then gave them lethal injections, and then photographed them, and those photographs went around the world.
And said that the Poles had attacked the German border post, and therefore they had to respond.
Now, that's amazingly enough, some actually survived the lethal injections as well. There were one or two that actually survived during the war and spoke briefly after the end of World War II.
Well, in actual fact, that's quite an interesting line of inquiry, because this kind of fascist psychological warfare technique, which is what we're really talking about now, psychological warfare in 1939 was pretty crude, yeah? I mean, nobody really believed, apart from the German propaganda machine, that the Poles had invaded, had attacked Germany.
Well, no, and we don't believe today, do we, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction? Well, no, we had two million people didn't believe. They went out on the streets of London.
Well, that's right. But of course, what actually happened at the end of World War II is a lot of the fascist intelligence personnel were recruited by the OSS, which became the CIA, and recruited into NATO. So Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head up the Gestapo in Eastern Europe and had loads of agents operating inside the Soviet Union, he became the head of the West German intelligence services. And if I was head of the KGB, that would be a pretty clear signal to me about what's going on here.
There's been a couple of scandals recently in Germany in the last 10 years, actually twice now. The German Bundesnachrichtendienst, BND, have been caught setting up fascist cells. And, you know, some of the key fascist right-wing, extreme right-wing organisers in Germany are beyond any doubt, you know, basically agents of the BND. It's been admitted.
I mean, we could actually at this point bring in some of the stories over the last couple of months to do with fascists in Germany and in Britain, because we've had the arrest in Germany of, this is I think just within the last week, of police who they say in Germany were fascists and were planning to assassinate left-wing leaders in Germany. We've also had the army lieutenant, Martin, I think we covered this story on this show, didn't we? German who had left a false trail as a Syrian refugee and was planning to blow up a bomb in Vienna airport. More recently, we've also had, just over the last couple of weeks, arrests in Britain or in the British Army by West Midlands police of what they believe are far-right extremists in a banned organisation here in Britain.
Well, also here in Britain, the bombings of Bologna, we mentioned Bologna railway station earlier, I did, in 1972, Dublin and Monaghan were bombed by loyalist terrorists in Ireland, killed 27 people, injured hundreds more. Simultaneous bombs in both Dublin and Monaghan in the rush hour as people were going home from work. And Justice Henry Barron, who's the head of the Irish Supreme Court, has written a report called The Barron Report on this attack, which points the finger very, very firmly at British intelligence for being behind those bombings. Now, in other words, there is a track record of British, US, Israeli intelligence services. And they're, of course, not the only ones. This kind of false flag terrorism, creating something shocking and outrageous so that you can then herd everybody like sheep in the direction you want them to go, is a tactic that's actually as old as warfare itself. But, of course, modern psychological warfare is very, very sophisticated.
Okay,
I think the key point about 9/11 from the psychological warfare point of view is that it was such a big event, and so, you know, paradoxically, people will say, well, I don't think they'd do anything that big.
That's right.
But actually, it works much better if it's big. Look at Oklahoma,
Isn't this called audacity or chutzpah?
Chutzpah, I think, yeah.
Well, if it's a big enough lie, isn't it a big enough lie, you might be more likely to get away?
It's more frightening to think that they're doing this on that scale than that they would do it just on maybe a small scale, just to justify.
Fascinating, over the last few weeks, we've seen these arrests of fascists within the system, within the police and within the army. German soldier arrested, planned false flag terror attack on Vienna airport. Refugees would take the blame. Neo-Nazi arrests. Four alleged members of National Action were arrested over terrorism. That's West Midlands Police. Commission preparation and instigation of acts of terror within the British Army.
Yeah, and you've got to remember that if you look at the history of Operation Gladio in Western Europe, the intelligence services were running all sorts of different kinds of terrorism. So it was fascist operatives who'd actually bombed Bologna railway station, but it was the Red Brigades who'd supposedly kidnapped Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister, although in fact both organisations, the fascists and the Red Brigades, were being manipulated by Caesar.
Now, in the attacks that happened here in Britain before the general election, many of the people had been reported to the anti-terror hotline. It seems here that actually the police themselves, the ordinary West Midlands police, we're not talking about MI5 here, are a bit of a different quantity to the Secret Services.
Well, the West Midlands police put a Swedish national on trial at the Old Bailey some years ago now, a couple of years ago now, because he was about to go off to Syria to join ISIS. And his defence lawyers argued perfectly successfully that in actual fact he was working with MI6, and MI6 were working with the groups that he was going to join, and so he was released. So in other words, there's a tension there between policing and the intelligence services. And if there are any police officers listening to this show, I would suggest to them that it's your job as the independent police force.
Or firefighters.
Well, firefighters can't go around arresting people.
No.
In Colombia a few years ago, there was something called Operation Dragon, which was orchestrated by the military high command, and they planned to assassinate all the trade union leaders, the main trade union leaders in Colombia, over a two-week period. And just before they were about to do that, the Colombian National Police raided Army headquarters and took away loads of information.
Okay, I'll put a link
and therefore thwarted it.
I'll put a link up to this most recent story about the British police arresting far-right British Army people, allegedly anyway, during a trip to the Buchenwald concentration camp in Germany last year. Masked members of this banned group displayed their flag and performed Hitler salutes in what they called an execution room. National Action describes itself as a National Socialist Youth Organisation, was known for using the phrases "Hitler was right" and "Britain is ours, the rest must go" at marches and online. It used social media to call for a white jihad.
Yeah, but what may be happening here is both the jihadis and the fascists are in fact straw organisations which are being manipulated by the intelligence services. There's plenty of nutty people out there.
Well, I thought it was rather odd the way that... What was that UK group called recently, you know, that was disbanded and collapsed? And it turned out that the guy running it, who'd been interviewed on Newsnight, they got a lot of help from Newsnight. They came from nowhere. Newsnight selected them out of nowhere. And then the guy turned out to be a militant Zionist, and resigned. He was sort of exposed because, you know, obviously he wasn't pretending to be that...
Well, something called the Quilliam Foundation I found fascinating, which Tommy Robinson, former founder of the EDL, joined... This is a sort of almost a fake Islamic pressure group, Martin.
Yeah, but
there is a reasonable side to Islam, and it's us. Yeah, the BBC put these people out as if they represent.
You've got to think about the way the intelligence services operate. So they've got extreme right wingers to frighten the Muslims and the liberals. They've got extreme Muslims on the payroll to frighten to frighten everybody else. And of course, they've also then got the moderates who are then going to say this is all wrong, and they're also on the payroll because we're actually in a completely manipulated reality. But one of the problems they've got in the modern era is the internet, because anybody who disputes anything we've said in the 2 hours of this programme can go away and immediately check it. Immediately. It's quite straightforward. You just have to get your phone out and you can do it. In the past, you couldn't do that. Could go on for ages and ages, and you'd have to go and to dig up the relevant documents would take for ages, take forever.
I read an interesting quote in The Independent when I was doing my 9/11 research about Ireland. They spoke to somebody who had been a British Army informant, and he said the attitude was, if there's anything happening, we want to own it. You know, that was the phrase.
That's right.
They wanted to own everything. And I think that's what you're saying, really. Martin.
Okay. One of the things I'd like to do is go back to one of the people who's made a big difference, as far as I can see, in explaining this to people who managed to find the time to go online and look at these things. Is this guy called Webster Tarpley? His "How to Stop World War III" talk, I think, was around about the same time, around about 2003, 2004. Here's a little extract from it, because he explains that if you have a quite close look at the 9/11 attacks, very much like the JFK assassination, you'll find the person that they're saying did it can't possibly have done it.
can Lee Harvey Oswald, using the Mannlicher Carcano 1917 rifle, successfully fire the requisite number of shots with bolt action in the time that he has? No. And it doesn't depend on his criminal intent. He can have all the criminal intent in the world. It won't let him do it. And these guys, you can say, oh, they hate us. Oh, they hate us. Doesn't matter how much they hate you. They can't do it. Okay, so this is a whole world of provocateurs, double agents. This is sort of the wormy underside of FBI, CIA, NSA, the rest of them.
And what Webster Tarby's saying here is that they didn't have enough flying training.
Network. This is important. They don't follow the chain of command, even. They're not certainly not loyal to a constitution, but they're rather loyal to a clique. It's ultimately in Wall Street, but it's also senior government officials, generals, and people like this. Those are the moles. They also have to organize the cover-up. The moles have to make sure that nobody interferes with the patsies before the fact. Not because the patsies are going to carry out the attack, but because if the patsies are already in jail, you can't blame the crime on the patsies. So they've got to stay free, and then they've got to be arrested immediately, and you've then got to have a cover-up. And then you have professional killers. There's got to be a role in this for, I believe, a privatized command center. There's got to be a role for assassins, in other words, people like the people who really killed Kennedy, coming into town, getting out of town. Patsies love attention. They love to get on TV. Again, Oswald gets on TV, gets on the radio, gets noticed. Atta, same thing, right? Always fighting with people, abrasive. Then the professional killers, who don't say anything. They come in, shoot, leave. They're not ideologues in the same sense. They're not interested in popping off in public. A privatized command center, certainly not Dick Cheney. Can you imagine you're going to have this whole operation, you're going to make it depend on a guy who's 4 heart attacks and 3 pacemakers, sitting there with his wife who keeps turning the CNN up so you can't hear the interagency task force talking? And the whole thing doesn't work without the brainwashed world of the controlled corporate media. Okay? And that's state-sponsored false flag terrorism, because the thing says we're Al-Qaeda, and they're not Al-Qaeda. They're a branch of CIA and MI6.
Well, Webster Tarpley, of course, is a very senior academic. He's got loads of degrees.
But he's also, he cut his teeth over in Italy, didn't he?
He was in Italy during the 70s, during the Gladio era. That's quite correct. And, of course, those who don't understand history don't really understand what's going on. And
you did a talk, didn't you? Well, gosh, must be around about 2005 or so, which we called False Flag Fever, where you talked about 9/11, but you never actually mentioned the 9/11 attacks at all.
That's right, because there's plenty of other evidence that this sort of thing goes on. So before you come to 9/11 and go, they wouldn't do something like that, you've got to take into account all the things that I've been stressing. The Bologna bombing, the bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, the Brabant massacres in Belgium in the 1980s. All of this stuff has been investigated and proven. But of course, nobody's ever put on trial, nobody ever goes to prison apart from small fry, and so on. And we don't have a state of laws. We have got effectively a fascist dictatorship, but with a democratic facade.
Well, and it's running under a state of emergency.
That's right. And France is currently under a state of emergency after the Charlie Hebdo. So permanent states of emergency. That is the goal here.
There's a huge
gulag of people where the habeas corpus and Magna Carta is out of the window, and hundreds of people are being held in these secret prisons which we're not even allowed to know where they are or what goes on in those prisons.
Isn't that exactly what these Islamists were supposed to want? That they hate our freedoms, they want us to take them up, to take our freedoms away?
Well, it's worse than that, because, I mean, the mainstream left, as it were, say, well, the Muslims are getting fed up because they're being attacked and bullied, and in one sense, they're right. But in actual fact, the most extreme Sunni jihadists are trained by our people. Saudi Arabia is our ally. British military personnel are currently in Saudi Arabia helping them target Houthi rebels inside Yemen.
Well,
in other words, we are complicit in everything that the Saudis do, and the Saudis are the heartland of Wahhabi extremism. If we were going to go anywhere to invade after 9/11, that surely should have been the place.
Are the Saudis actually allied with the Israelis?
Yes, they are. The Israelis and the Saudis are allied. I mean, in Syria, they are on the same side. That's exactly what's been going on for a long time.
And but it of course, was raised, actually, in the media. It actually came out on the sort of gossipy parts of the political media that they were sort of quasi-publicly admitting this.
Yes, it's pretty much well known to everybody. But of course, out there in the sort of normal society, people say, but surely the Saudis hate the Israelis and the Israelis hate the Saudis. You say, no, they don't. And in actual fact, when there was attempted to remove Prince Salman recently, the Israelis sent aircraft to Saudi Arabia to support him. And of course, they may use Saudi Arabia as a base to attack Iran.
Well, they're already talking about potentially getting involved in Syria, aren't they? The Israelis, just the last week.
Well, they did it. They carried out a bombing raid yesterday. What they claimed was a chemical weapons factory, but of course the Syrians deny that. I mean, on what basis are they allowed to do that? Well, they're not really supposed to do that at all. The war's already raging. People are dying every day.
One of the more interesting, I mean, I spoke to writer Soraya Sepafor-Ulrich a couple of years ago, and she pointed out that many of these security companies are actually owned by Israeli companies and Israeli firms.
Well, that's why I mentioned that earlier, but the whole privatisation of security, the Israelis present themselves, say, oh, we're the experts on fighting Islamist terrorism, so you need us. So they end up running ICTS, running the various airports, and of course, Verint Systems, which is another Israeli-linked, Mossad-linked company, they control the CCTV on the London Underground.
Well, anyway, let's go over to the United States and have a reminder now of what Soraya Sepafor-Ulrich had to say to me a couple of years ago.
Israel conducts U.S. foreign policy. I mean, the most prominent scholars have said that Israeli, like Mearsheimer and Walt, they've said that Israel shapes U.S. foreign policy. You only have to look at the Israeli lobby groups, AIPAC being the most powerful, but then AIPAC is the muscle. It doesn't formulate ideas. It's all the pro-Israeli think tanks in the United States that come up with these policy papers, and then they're implemented by whichever administration happens to be in office. And AIPAC is the muscle, you know, says, you know, you have to do this, and we'll buy you or we don't buy you. But also another thing that's very frustrating, I think, about the United States, and very few people even give it a second thought, is all the security in the United States is run by Israeli governments, including FBI, including water treatment plants, including the nuclear sites, including the airports. And the danger of having Israeli firms in charge of all these securities is just beyond anybody's imagination. So even if AIPAC were to pull back and say, okay, I'm a foreign agent, I won't interfere, there is still this problem with the security of the United States being in the hands of Israeli firms. And so Israel's power over America is not just in the fact that they can buy politicians. It's a lot more complex than that, and a lot more threatening to the country.
Empire, aren't we? And I mean, I think you might have made this case for South Africa. You know, people would have said, well, South Africa is controlling Britain, you know, before, you know, the collapse of apartheid, when we were supporting the apartheid state in South Africa. But I think the way the empire works is that they have a sort of lead country for each part of the globe, and Israel's the lead country for the Middle East.
But how do you explain all these links from Israeli software companies and security companies?
Well, the whole thing, lots of things
you can find links in any way.
There's millions of links. Everybody's linked to everybody else. It's quite easy to find links. I think she's slightly exaggerated there, to be honest.
Well, she's saying that the security companies that are in charge of major sites, often the Israelis win those contracts.
I would agree with that, but I think she said something a little bit more than that, a little bit more
total. Well, she's also saying that the Israelis, to a large extent, control much of the U.S. foreign policy. Martin, what do you think?
Well, what about Ukraine? I mean, we've had fascists. We put fascists into power in Ukraine. I don't think Israel was terribly happy about that.
No, that's not true. Kolomoisky in Ukraine is a very interesting character. He's Jewish, and he's an oligarch. And he's aligned with Svoboda, which are the fascists. So in actual fact, and of course we've covered on other shows that we've done, Tony, the links between Martin Bormann, who probably escaped from Berlin with British help at the end of the war, and when he set up his front organisations in Latin America, he made very sure to have lots and lots of Jewish people involved. So the idea that Jews can't be fascists, I'm afraid, is just wrong.
Oh, totally.
Right wingers hate.
Well, Einstein himself Einstein himself compared the Zionists to fascists. He turned down the offer of becoming president of Israel. But let's be clear here, there's a few different things. We don't want to mix them up. There's Jewish people, there's Israel, there's Zionists, there's anti-Zionists. You can have any combination of that. So I think, you know, when we say Israel, we need to be just a little bit careful about exactly what
we are talking about. The state of Israel.
Let's remember one more.
The state.
Let's remember one more thing about. Sorry, I've lost my thread there. So I'll come back to it.
Okay. I'd also like to talk. Because I did speak a couple of weeks ago to a guy called Manfred Petrisch. He runs a blog in German language called All Smoke and Mirrors. He's a former Swiss banker, and also he was born to a German family in Argentina just after World War II. I think I'll leave it at that. He's now moved to the Black Sea, to Abkhazia. He's had enough of the West, and he has, I think, quite an interesting take on how the police state has started to, because we're starting to touch on some of those elements there, and the way civil liberties have been being destroyed since the September 11th attacks. And this is for a really, I mean, he just wasn't born in Germany, but this is really a German point of view.
Every time there is a terror attack, they want to have more competence regarding watching us and listening to us and destroying all the freedoms and the constitutional rights. And every time, and then when they have more competence, still there is a terror attack, and then they ask for more. So what is happening is, in the last 16 years, they have asked for more and more and more police power to invade your home, to listen to what you're doing, to store all your communications on the internet and the telephone and the mobile phone and all these things. And still there are terror attacks happening, which means that it's not about fighting terrorism. It never was. This is just an excuse for the stupid people.
Yeah.
It's what Orwell wrote in his book, 1984. It is the complete controlled state, the big brother watching you. He predicted it all, and we have it all now. And we have even more than he predicted. It's all heading into the so-called world government, which means that there is only one European government in the form of EU. That's a step in between to the big union, which will be a world government. That's what they want to achieve. They want to have just one government that controls everything, world domination. It has always been, if you go back thousands of years, it has always been the aim of emperors and kings and dictators and whatever to control the whole world. That's always been their aim.
I think it was James Bond film Dr. No, wasn't it, where James Bond himself says, oh, world domination, the same old dream.
Exactly. And that's what they are trying to achieve through different means, by doing all this North American Union and European Union and Asian Union and African Union. In the end, what they do, they join all these unions together and they will have the World Union. There has been a huge concentration of corporations. They have become monsters. They have become so big that they are bigger than countries. I mean, if you look at the balance sheet of these big corporations, they're bigger than the budget of many countries. They are above countries, and that's why they introduce globalism. Globalism only helps the huge world corporations, because then they can install their factories where they have the cheapest labor. They can install their headquarters in the place where they have the lowest tax. They can install their research department in that country which has the most lax environment laws. So they are the profiters of the globalism. You and I, we don't profit. And also the middle and small business don't profit from globalism. Only the big corporations. And they dictate all the laws to the governments. And this is, you can see this in the EU. The EU was only formed so that the big corporations can sell all their stuff into one big market of 500 million people. That's why it was created. Because then before, they had to have abide by the French law and the German law and the Italian law and the British law, and they had to do all these different changes. So what they said is, hey, we are sick and tired of this. Let's get rid of all this stuff and just have one big union, and then we can just sell the same stuff to everybody.
Okay, but how do we stop this globalism, assuming that this is a kind of totalitarian system that's gathering force here? Is there any way to stop it?
Well, you did it with Brexit. And that was the biggest kick in the groin for the globalists that anybody ever did. That's why I congratulate the British people that they voted for the Brexit. This is great. You see, what has to happen is all the countries have to regain their sovereignty. They have to regain control over their borders, regain control over their financial system, regain control about all the laws, and not be dictated from an unelected apparatchik in Brussels who dictates what you have to do. I mean, these people in Brussels, nobody has ever elected anybody of those. You cannot elect the head of the European Commission. You cannot elect the president of the Commission. You cannot select any of the Commission members. So, well, where is there democracy in the EU? There is none. This is actually a copy of the Soviet Union, of the UdSSR. The EU is a copy of that.
Well, that's one view anyway. That's Manfred Petrich from All Smoke and Mirrors, and he's really saying there effectively, Martin, that the 9/11 attacks are part of a wider attempt at globalism and world domination. Is that too far-fetched?
No, it's not. But you've got to remember that, in actual fact, the Russians and the Chinese aren't in on this game, which is why they're being forced.
Well, one of the things he said, which I haven't put on here tonight, is that the only reason we're not in World War III now is because of Putin.
Well, the Russians and the Russians have managed to rebuild their state as a democratic state, relatively speaking, and their armed forces. When I used to go over there in the 1990s, the place was in freefall. Absolute free fall. And of course, Putin, when he first came to power, through false flag terrorism, possibly, is a big topic that we could go into there about the bombs in Moscow and Ryazan. But he's double crossed his backers, and he's trying to build up a Russian power which is not controlled by international corporations. So, for example, they've still got a nationalized railway, nationalized oil industry, etc., all of which has got to go as far as Western corporations are concerned. But they are not able to have everything their way. The idea that they are completely in control and that they're manipulating everything.
Oh, no,
they are very evil.
Definitely not.
But they don't necessarily. Warfare is a very, very risky business.
Sort of traditional empire in a way, and I think it's mainly centered on Washington. Washington and London, maybe
right.
Tel Aviv.
And Tel Aviv, yeah.
You know, and Brussels.
Anyway,
but
I thought we'd finish up with listening to Sybil Edmonds talking about ISIS, because this is one of the things that seems to have spun out of the 9/11 attacks and all the focus on the Middle East is the growth of ISIS. She's a former FBI translator, Turkish translator turned whistleblower. So anyone that thinks there aren't enough whistleblowers around, well, they have not been listening to this show, have they?
I can speak for the people here in the United States. First of all, for them it's easy to digest, and most people here have been systematically stripped off of their critical thinking ability. They just want some sound bites from the mainstream media. They want sound bites from their TV news. I mean, it's really blurry, the difference between fiction-based sitcoms and what you watch on these types of news with, let's say, CBS or NBC. Mm-hmm. It's very, very blurry, and they work hand in hand, and they accept it. And then we have to admit, they have created, especially since 9/11, an entire industry, you know, from intelligence complex to military industrial complex, as I said, contractors, subcontractors, you are looking at domestically, at least here in the United States, in trillions of dollars. And then if you start going outward and internationally in terms of gaining dominance in the region, and whether it's with Iraq and Syria and the Middle East, or what's going to come, and it has been at work in Central Asia, Ukraine kind of quieted down, but we actually got what we wanted to get out of that. Next, we are going to see, and that's my prediction, we are going to see some unrest in Georgia, because there are going to be these so-called terror events that are going to be blamed on some ferocious Chechen faction that may be collaborating with ISIS faction, and that's going to lead to Georgia's becoming formally, officially accepted into NATO as a member. We already have troops in Georgia. It's already on its way.
That was former FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds there. She's talked, Martin, about, for example, about a kind of almost a prison where ISIS is this thing you've just got to believe in and you can't get out of it.
Well, Rita Katz's website tells us all about ISIS, and of course she, what's it called?
Search for international terrorist entities.
Searching internet for terrorist entities. Most ISIS PR seems to come through her, even though she's definitely an ex-Israeli intelligence agent. In terms of what we can do to try and do anything about this, I think we've got to make demands of the police and the intelligence services. And we've said some pretty harsh things about the intelligence services here. They're not to be trusted. And when the police are investigating the events that we've seen, for example, recently in Britain, they should, one of the things that they should be bearing in mind is the role of the intelligence services in terrorist attacks. It's not crazy. It's perfectly straightforward, as Justice Henry Barron pointed out about the 1972 attacks in Dublin and Monaghan. The Garda Síochána investigated it, they looked into it, they pointed the finger at MI6. When Imposimato in the US, in Italy investigated what was going on there, he wrote a book, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, that came out in 2012. The police have got to do their job.
Well, I'd also add the fire brigades, you know, because the fire people, they lost 300 people in 9/11, and there is a lot of debate going on in the fire brigades union now. So if you do know anybody who's a fireman, a firefighter,
anybody who knows a fireman, let them have a listen to the sound, the voices of the fire brigade in New York just before
Bravo
the buildings
7.
Came down.
There's a video being shown on Sunday, actually, about search Bravo 7 and you'll find it.
Absolutely shocking that they said, well, we pretty much put the fire out, and then all of a sudden a massive explosion and they're all died in a controlled demolition.
Yeah, they were halfway up. They were reporting that it was safe to go up because it probably was before the demolition went
on. So anyway, your book is 9/11 the New Evidence.
9/11 the New Evidence, Ian Henshall. Reinvestigate911.org is our website. Facebook? I'm not a huge believer in Facebook, but we do have a Facebook page.
Well, a lot of people, particularly young people, they don't watch television anymore. They're getting all their info from social media. So
yeah.
It's kind of, you know, we're almost in a straitjacket, aren't we, with Facebook?
But what you can do is to give people your email, give trusted people your email, because if I email you, it'll get through. If I put a Facebook post out, it probably won't. The picture of the head of the CIA unit who should have stopped 9/11, I put that on Facebook. It got 24 people looked at it, so-called. When I mentioned Chomsky, it goes to 1,000. Facebook is controlled. Really, obviously, it is controlled. So please don't trust Facebook. Use it by all means, but don't trust it.
Good tip. Thanks
very
much.
Go on an email list. Much more likely to get.
Finally, any thoughts about the next night, big 9/11, or even bigger this time, Martin? Any thoughts on that?
One of the things we're doing by investigating this way, we're trying to deter these criminals. If they do try anything else, we're going to be all over it, and they better know that.
Yeah, and the people around them are going to possibly make reports. So, you know, rather than not seeing what might be obvious with hindsight, now it's much more difficult for them because everybody knows about these so-called.
I mean, we're dealing effectively
theories.
With a kind of failure in law enforcement in the West here,
it's
aren't
a massive failure.
Absolutely.
All through the doctrine of who watches the watchers, because if you start suggesting that law enforcement should apply to politicians, they're going to start saying, oh, what about the Committee for Public Safety in the French Revolution? You know, they demand the right to be in a crime-free zone. Anyway, we can't allow that.
Thanks very much to author of 9/11 and New Evidence, Ian Henshaw, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. 2 whole hours on the 16th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, just coming up in a few days' time. This story's show story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. Well, I'll put links up to a lot of what we've been talking about tonight, most of the main stuff anyway. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1978 and Genesis. Do please join us for a politics show next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
FM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.